This is Digital Music Trends, episode 101, recorded on the 13th of September, 2012. Well, welcome to the show and thanks for tuning in. If you're a long-time listener, you'll notice that this is an entirely new format. So effectively, this is an episode one of sorts. And if you're an audio subscriber, it's worth mentioning that Digital Music Trends will also now be available as a video show, both on iTunes, RSS, and YouTube, which is why those of you enjoying that version will probably already be seeing the co-hosts around me somewhere in the video. So let's start with some introductions. We have Darren Hemmings here, founder of Motive Unknown Consultancy, which works with a variety of clients specializing in digital marketing. Darren was also the head of digital marketing at PS up until last year. So hi, Darren, and thanks for joining us. How's it going today?
Yeah, I'm very good. Thank you.
Perfect. Also on the show, we have Eamon Ford. And if you're an aficionado of both mainstream and industry-focused music publications, you'll have come across quite a few pieces by Eamon in the past few years. He's definitely one of the best journalists in the business. So it's great to have you on. And what are you working on at the moment? Everything is going all right?
What am I working on at the moment? I'm writing a piece for Q Magazine about the weediest, wettest songs that have ever been recorded. So awesome. You'll see that in the next issue.
Great.
That was the last thing I filed, where I was able to lay into the likes of Hue and Cry and the Spice Girls for writing terrible, mawkish songs.
Nice. Fantastic. And the fourth co-host of the show today, so last but not least, is Elliot van Buskirk, editor-in-chief of The Echonest. He's the brains behind Evolver.fm, which is a consumer-facing publication talking about music, tech, apps, and everything in between, basically. So Elliot also used to work at CNET and Wired, so it's great having you on, and hope you're well. And also, it's interesting to see a consumer-facing publication like Evolver spurred by a startup like The Echonest. It's not a usual thing. So how are you finding it?
I think my audio dropped out, but I think you're wondering how it's going with The Echonest, which is great. I mean, when I was coming up at CNET, I was their sort of main digital music guy for years. I think I was there for 9 years, which in .com time is an eternity.
Yeah.
And then at Wired, I sort of branched out and was doing more digital media stuff. And now I'm back to just doing digital music again, just in time for this whole app revolution. So I think the timing's pretty good from my perspective there.
That's great. Cool. So, we're going to cover some of the stories that have happened in the past week in the digital music world. That's the aim, anyway, of the show. So let's start with the latest Apple rumors. Which is kind of something we have to cover, even though I'm sure everybody's covering it to death already. But last week, there were actually a few things that came up that were concerning directly digital music for once, because Apple hasn't been really doing much in that field for a while since iTunes Match. So the rumor is that Apple is working with labels to create a new radio service, which is kind of Pandora style more than Spotify style. These talks are just beginning, but apparently this is something that Apple is really keen on doing. My take is that maybe it's something they need to do because they're losing the consumers of content as they go to different services like Netflix and Spotify for what they need, which makes Apple a little more dispensable as a company. But let's start with Elliot. What do you think about this possible move?
I think it makes sense. I mean, to me, it's sort of a case of why not, It's fairly standard to set up an internet radio service. You know, at least in the United States, and I think elsewhere, you know exactly what it's going to cost you. The licenses are just sitting there unless you want to negotiate direct licenses. And you're right. I mean, we haven't seen a lot of action from Apple of late. You know, they dominated the download space clearly. And now that more and more people are streaming, I'm hard pressed to think of a reason why they wouldn't want to do something like this.
Yeah, exactly. And Darren, what do you think? Do you think that Apple is actually going to get into what is essentially a loss leader for them?
I think it'd be interesting to see, but I'm kind of with Elliot. It's why wouldn't you do it? You know, it makes common sense to do it. I mean, I'm it's a funny one really, because I on a personal level, I find myself wondering who uses these radio services, because certainly in the UK, I mean, I think in the US, Pandora has kind of dominated that area and has been a front runner in that respect. But in the UK, it sort of feels less so. And it's one of those weird things where anecdotally, I don't really know anyone that actually uses these things. It's a bit like when Spotify launched the Spotify radio. I mean, I could see why they were doing it and what the motivation was. But in terms of it being like a big move, it was less so, you know, and so for me, it's it makes sense. It seems like an easy thing for them to do, and an additional feature, and that's all good. I think, to be honest, probably a bigger question is when Apple are just going to launch an out and out kind of Spotify competitor by way of a streaming service. That's the big move. The radio thing's just nice addition, broaden things out a little more. But yeah, I don't think it will make a huge impact, really, is my own view. I'm happy to be proven wrong, but great, but personally I kind of shrugged, if I'm totally honest.
And Eamon, what do you think? Do you think Pandora should have dropped as it did in terms of stock? And do you think, you know, other services should be worried that Apple is prepared to come into a field like this, where they're not really, they don't care about making any money, really, because they make money off devices, but they just want to provide the best experience to consumers?
Yeah, well, I think the issue here is it's expertise in this area. Apple's got expertise in lots of different areas. It doesn't have it in this area. And Pandora has been at this for, over a decade. And it has still been hemorrhaging money. There's been a few periods when it's made some money. But they've kind of put a lot into building this whole market. And they are the front runners, certainly in the States. So I don't know why Apple would try and buy into that market. It's like Apple trying to set up a search engine. Other people do it better. I think Apple's ultimate goal is, if those services work on their devices, then Apple wins. If these services work incredibly well on the iPad or on the, if it ever launches the Apple TV set, it's all about those devices. So I don't know why Apple would throw money at something like that, because the wider demand is going to be on demand listening rather than a kind of radio style listening. You can build in a radio style feature on something like Spotify, but I think Apple coming in with this, it's something they would have done 10 years ago. So it seems really odd that they would see this as a priority product. But
absolutely,
we'll find out this afternoon if they will. But then their last kind of big music play was Ping, and that was an absolute disaster. So it doesn't kind of bode well for this.
Yeah, for sure.
I'd like to address something you said there, the on-demand versus radio. I mean, I think a lot of us who, you know, I know you write about music, I've written about music, and a lot of us think about this stuff all day, but to a great many people, they just want to hit one button and go about their business and have the music be, like, pretty good. You know, I think there's a danger with some of us who are just so deep into it, you know, and I think I subscribe to multiple services just to see what they're doing. And of course I want to hear exactly what I want to hear all the time. But you know, my wife, for instance, listens to streaming radio mostly. I mean, there are a few albums, there's like basically one or two albums that she'll want to stream every once in a while. Otherwise it's like, you know, the Smiths Pandora station is good enough for her. And it's way better than anything that FM radio used to offer already. So anyway, I mean, I agree with you. Like, I definitely want a service where I can hear anything I want. And I know that hardcore music fans are like that. But for people who are just sort of, you know, working in an office or doing housework or cooking something, you know, they have other stuff to do. They want to just hit one button and go. So I think there is a place for streaming radio. And now that we're seeing apps in the car, you know, when you're in a car, you don't really want to be going, okay, like, which Led Zeppelin album do I want to listen to right now? Because you'll wind up in the hospital or worse. I think that once we see these apps go into the car, it could make even sense for the hardcore music fans like us to get into streaming radio. I agree with what you're saying, though. I just thought I'd try to make that.
Yeah, I just think this whole idea of streaming radio, it's a nice add-on to a broader service. But for Apple to come with this as a standalone service, it just seems massively anachronistic for them, for a company that's always kind of hailed as being kind of plowing a brave new future and taking us all with it. I think if they build it into a kind of on-demand stream on iTunes, then yeah, but as a standalone thing, I don't really see where their point of differentiation in the market's going to be, because Pandora's struggled for a long time to build up that momentum, and Apple may have an installed base, but their users have got to get used from going from ripping CDs and downloading from iTunes to listening in a whole new way. So it's going to take a long time to shift those consumers.
Yeah. Yeah, good points. Absolutely. So let's move on to the next story. I wanted to cover this just because I think it's an interesting thing that it fed into the mainstream media quite so well. And it was the whole Bruce Willis, suing Apple shenanigan, which for those of you who haven't heard about it in terms of listeners, basically the story was that Bruce Willis was so upset that his lawyers told him that he couldn't really legally leave his iTunes music to his daughters that he was contemplating suing Apple about it. It turned out a couple of days later that the story wasn't actually real, as Bruce Willis's wife actually tweeted that it was all bogus. But it made the rounds. It's actually incredible that it was reported by all the major media outlets without a fact checking, which was quite strange. But it kind of raised a broader question as to what we do with our digital music once we die, what happens to it, and not just digital music, but digital assets in general, including books and videos and all that. So Eamon, had you thought much about sort of leaving your digital collection to somebody?
Well, I don't know if you can see behind me, I've got walls of CDs. So I kind of like the assurance of a lot of that. But I wouldn't, because there's something massively presumptuous to say that your offspring should want your record collection, because the last thing I would want is my mum and dad's music collection, because you, as a kid, you define yourself against what your parents like. So I think that's not really the issue. But obviously the issue is, well, you paid for this stuff, but it's restricted to you. But of course there's ways and means around that. All you have to do is burn it onto CDR or put it onto a DVD and or an external hard drive, and that's fine. But yeah, I guess it is this whole issue of, if everything's kind of moving to the cloud and everything's kind of being stored remotely or stored digitally, what does that mean in terms of kind of personal archive? And yeah, that's going to be important for as kind of family heirlooms or mementos of kind of people past. But I think it kind of raised an issue, and it made a big issue of something that isn't really that big an issue, because if everything's ultimately going to go to on demand, be that Spotify or YouTube or Hulu or Vimeo or whatever, the whole idea of everything, it's going to be on there anyway. So all he has to leave is just a list of his favorite tracks. So they just have to look at his playlists or his favorites, things like that, and see, it'll probably all be the Return of Bruno played over and over again.
Yeah, and I mean, Mark Mulligan.
I haven't thought about that track in so long.
Classic.
Yeah.
No, Mark Mulligan pointed out in his blog as well that that's always been the case, you know, with CDs, with LPs. There was always a disclaimer saying that really the license was non-transferable, that you didn't actually own the music. A lot of the articles headlined, "Oh, you don't actually own the music from iTunes," but that's been true of every single media that we bought. Really, it's just the convenience of the physical format that allows you to actually give something to somebody and or sell it.
Yeah, but maybe just one final point. It's probably just an issue of what you do with your passwords, and that's probably the wider issue about what's your password to get into your laptop and your Hotmail account and stuff like that. So that probably will become a feature in wills, where one person is entrusted with all of that stuff, whether or not they want to remove any questionable content from your browser history or from your hard drive. Mm-hmm. Somebody kind of swoops in like some kind of CIA agent and kind of wipes all the bad stuff off your computer. But you can bequeath your iTunes password to somebody if you want, and you can have that disconnected from your credit card at the end. So yeah, you can pass that stuff on. So I suppose there are wider issues there about passwords, because it's all got to hinge on passwords rather than content.
I know.
Yeah, there's another interesting thing too, which is, you know, if you pay for iCloud or you pay for Spotify or you pay for something that has a monthly payment, you know, how long do your heirs continue to pay? You know, maybe the first year they're like, "Oh, it's so great to listen to dad's music." And then 10 years later, it's like, maybe not. But the other funny thing that just occurred to me, I don't know if you guys remember this news story, but there was this digital tombstone company that I read about, where they'll put up an actual, you know, a screen on your tombstone, and you can select, you know, music and movies and pictures that you want to be on there. So when people visit, they kind of tap at the thing and, "Oh yeah, he really did love that at Benny Hill, you know.
Can it be a feed into the coffer, into the casket, so you can slowly decompose?
Well, that's a little bit morbid, but...
Somebody can take a picture and then it could be the cover of, I don't know, the next Iron Maiden album or something.
Sure, yeah. I'm sure it'll happen. But, you know, it brings up this whole idea of what happens to your iTunes. I mean, it does bring up an issue of this overall feeling where, you know, when the laws about all this stuff were getting set up, it was very much about, you know, how do we deal with criminals and infringers? And I think now that there are so many legal services, a lot of us aren't infringers anymore, and we're still getting treated like we are. So it'll be interesting to see if any of that changes, I guess. Yeah. There are always greater priorities in any government than what do we do about digital music licensing. So I think some of this stuff just kind of sits there and the laws always don't always match reality.
Yeah.
I think for me, I guess because I'm the guy doing marketing, the biggest thing for me was looking at it thinking it's a triumph somewhere that someone managed to get this story thrust into the public eye by using Bruce Willis's name. Because, you know, if someone just brought the topic up generally, there's no way it would become this much of a discussed area, you know. So I don't know how this started, but I really want to find the person that just seeded the story to start with, because it's genius.
It's got to be Ashton Kutcher, for sure, right?
Yeah, you know, it's got to be just whoever managed to get it out there such that we're all talking about it now is a you know, a kind of guy I would love to have working with me, because that is masterstroke.
Yeah, has Ashton Kutcher just invested in one of these kind of legacy server clients or whatever for people?
That would be follow the money, right? Follow the money.
Yeah. Indeed.
Well, I wanted to segue actually this story by talking quickly about Share My Playlist and the fact that they've sort of diversified their business model by moving into creating Spotify apps for other companies. And I was thinking about playlists as something related to this, in that if there's a way to standardize playlists in a way that they can be exported and shared across different services, like what the guys at Tomahawk are trying to do, then it becomes a much more compelling way to pass on your music tastes and your music collection to somebody else as a structured metadata, so that they don't have to use the same service you used to have, or even have the same files stored that you used to have, but they have a collection of the playlists that you used to listen to as a metadata file, so they can apply it to whatever service they're using. So Darren, what do you think that? Do you think that's just a crazy idea?
I mean, I'd love to see it as an idea, and the whole, you know, I think all data should be portable. And obviously, in other areas, this has come up quite a few times as regards, you know, taking your data out of one service to put in another. But the reality is that in a commercial environment, you know, just as Apple proved so brilliantly with the walled garden, that they have absolutely no desire to make it easy for you to leave their service, because if they did, there'd be no consumer loyalty. The minute someone dropped prices, you know, if Spotify and RDO, for example, were slightly more in contention, I guess, on an even footing, you know, you just get a price war, and everyone would just edge down prices, and people will hop from one to the other and back again, and things like that. Personally, I'd love to see it, and I've seen that, you know, the VP of engineering for RDO has said that he would also like to see it, and that they would like a much more kind of open platform. But you know that Spotify, until they're absolutely got the gun to their head, and not going to play ball with that.
There was a service, Wimp, kind of Scandinavian competitor to Spotify, based in Norway, I think. Found it in Norway, yeah, in Oslo. They were offering that a couple of years ago when Spotify launched, when they came after Spotify. So it was a way to kind of poach consumers. So they said that you can send them their playlists, and then they'll port them across into the Wimp service. So I don't know the exact details of how that worked, but it's all metadata. So if you can kind of pull down the metadata out of the service, which it's a bit of software, so you can do that legally and straightforwardly, or somebody can write a little hack that basically just throws all your metadata into some kind of spreadsheet or file, and then you just reload it into your new service. So it's probably it's probably the easiest thing in the world to pirate. So I don't know if that it, I don't know if when we're using that merely just as a kind of PR angle to get people to that. Because that's a whole Sean Parker argument about Spotify is once you build up lots and lots of playlists, they've kind of got you, and then they will upsell you to subscription and so forth. But if it becomes a fight over ownership of playlists, then yeah, I can understand why Spotify and others would want to kind of lock down on that. Yeah. But then again, is it like, would they legally have to hand it over? It's like when you want to change mobile phone operator, you get your plat code, and as long as you paid your bill, you're legally allowed to move across. So maybe it's going to become like that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's funny, actually, just to touch on your Spotify comment, because I'm now much more of an audio user than a Spotify one. And it's specifically because of the fact that Spotify's kind of interface is so unwieldy and horrific for me that trying to manage these playlists where you can't have them separate to albums and things like that just means you wind up with a kind of fairly unorganizable load of crap in your client. And the big pull for audio for me was that it behaves more like iTunes, and you can have your albums over here and your playlist over here so that you very much keep separated, and it organizes them in a much more orderly manner for you. So it's kind of interesting you say that, because for me, the overwhelming disorganization of my Spotify setup generally was a big motivation in kind of declaring bankruptcy for the most part and moving over to audio, where it felt like everything was ordered for me.
Yeah, well, I use both, but I prefer the interface in audio. The app's much better. The desktop player's a lot better, obviously, because I have both hooked up to Sonos, so they both kind of look the same when you're within Sonos. But I suppose the one thing that Spotify has to its advantage is that lots of people are on there and lots of people are making playlists. So I end up kind of cherry pick and playlist that friends are circulating, be it on Spotify or on Facebook, and then I play it through there. But obviously, if there's a way to export that to audio, I probably would.
Yeah.
I'd like to weigh in on this too. One of my favorite articles I've ever written was this thing for Wired called, I think it was 4 Reasons Music Needs One Big Database. And I was arguing exactly for this, for sort of the ability to move playlists from one service to another, to share it, you know, regardless of what your friends use, very much the Tomahawk idea. But the point that I was proud of making, or one, you know, one of them, yay for me, I wrote a great article, but we all have our favorites, was that, you know, that the big barrier for a lot of people to subscribing to one of these is, what if I spend 5 years in this service and I build up all my playlists and I'm in there and then something else comes out and I'm trapped? You know, why do I want to make a commitment? Why do I want to spend money if I'm just in this like roach motel or whatever you want to call it, where then you have to rebuild your entire musical environment from scratch every time something cool comes out? And so if all of these services banded together and formed some type of consortium, or, you know, they each give a board member to some organization that's just about interoperability, and they say, okay, like, let's just compete. Let's see who can actually win this thing. And we each get to tell our potential customers that they're not trapped. More people, I think, would subscribe. If you're really thinking about $10 a month for the rest of my life, regardless of who I'm buying it from, and I get the same playlists and same ratings and same, you know, everything that you build into this stuff, I think more people would subscribe, and it would, you know, whatever expression you want to use, grow the pie, raise the water level across the board. You know, I think it could help all of them. It would take a little bit of fearlessness on their part, because then they'd really have to compete. So that's the barrier.
I suppose that's the equivalent to the Philips Redbook standard for CDs that was introduced in the 80s, so that if you wanted to carry the CD logo either as the manufacturer of discs or manufacturer of CD player, obviously Philips got a royalty from each, but you entered into this explicit agreement that your CD would play on any CD player and your CD player would play any CD. So
exactly. It never would have taken off. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and it seems like we've kind of ended up talking about Spotify, which was another thing that I wanted to just quickly talk about, because they've had quite a few bits of news. It's mostly rumors really out this week, mostly about the new web-based client that is in the works. There are also some stories that started from the New York Times blog, talking about the fact that Spotify is making a profit off their paying customers, but it's still losing money due to the huge amount of free plays that people that are ad sponsored, but that don't generate enough money to actually for them to recuperate the money they have to pay to the music industry. And there were a couple of interesting articles that you guys wrote, one from Elliot and one from Darren. So I wanted to start with Elliot's talking about the fact that music is too expensive to be free, but too free to be expensive. So just quickly sum up your thoughts on that.
Well, yeah, Spotify is dealing with the same problem that all of these companies deal with, which is there is always a free option. And, you know, when I first met Daniel Ek, which is not Eck, I was surprised. It's apparently Ek.
Oh, right.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I heard. Maybe somebody was playing with me. I don't know. But
I thought that came from TechCrunch, I think, or one of those other kind of weblogs. Kind of taken the piss out of them because they always go Daniel Ek, Ek, and they were always it's TechCrunch or one of those ones who were always having a pop at Spotify because I think they got off on the wrong feed or there was some kind of early bad blood. So they always hammered that point. So I think it is Ek.
Well, somebody somewhere is laughing at me, but there it is. I've said it before. I'll probably fall for it again.
But
what impressed me about him was that he acknowledged that he's competing with free, and actually used to be the CEO of uTorrent, which was, you know, basically the most popular BitTorrent client in the world. And he goes from that to being the head of the top music subscription in the world. And I think it's because of that experience, realizing how big the free music community is out there. The danger is, you know, what I meant by music is too expensive to be free and too free to be expensive. You know, the second part is that you have to compete with free from that expression. And the first part is that you have to pay royalties. So that's why Spotify is kind of up against it, is that they are trying to do both, which I think is the only way to pull this off, is to offer both free and paid services. It's just where do you draw the line and how big can you make it and how many ads can you annoy people with so that they want to upgrade without just switching to something else. But he's got the basic formula right, and he did from the very start. The danger is that if you're a rights holder and you're getting paid, you don't care whether that person stays in business because there's going to be another guy right behind him with another big idea, and then he's going to give you big advances. Or they got iMeme sort of was bled dry, tried to do the same thing sort of that Spotify's doing, and so the danger is that the traditional arm of the music industry, you know, might be more than happy to just see startup after startup injecting all of its venture capital money into the labels and then going bankrupt. You know, maybe they don't care. But there will come a point where something has to work, right? Whether it's Spotify or something else, because you know, eventually investors will just say, well, forget it, you know.
I don't think any of the investors are investing in those types of services. Because certainly, if you speak to people like Sol Klein at Index Ventures or guy, his name's completely escaped me from Union Square, Fred Wilson, neither of them will touch any kind of Spotify style service. Anything that involves a license, they won't go near.
Yeah.
So if that tells you where the VC world is at the minute, they're happy to invest in things like SoundCloud or Songkick, but they wouldn't touch the next audio or the next Deezer.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Understandable.
Understandable. Yeah. Yeah. And Darren, you had another article on Spotify this week, which was published by our Music Ally, which was talking about another sort of issue that's surrounding the whole Spotify ecosystem, which is the fact that there is no publicly available data on the number of streams that are happening, which means that if a band puts an album out on Spotify, they have no way of influencing their presence or showing how much people are listening to it on the service. So what got you to thinking about that? And obviously, because you come from a marketing sort of perspective and you have to make choices as to where your artists are going to put the music.
And I think really it's a pretty deep area to get into, and it's quite a dangerous one for someone like me who's still working with bands and in marketing, because a lot of it relates to working with artists that have aspirations at radio. And certainly in the UK, you know, Radio 1 is still the kingmaker in that respect. If you get a playlisting or, you know, certainly an A-list, you know, it makes or breaks artists. You know, if an artist doesn't get playlisted and they are a radio-friendly artist, then it can be the nail in the coffin for the campaign. And the flip side of that is if you get an A-list or potentially an unexpected one, you know, then your campaign is off and running, and it's a real kickstart to things. So within all that, Radio 1 are obviously then looking for certain statistics to see what buzz there is around an artist and a campaign. And the problem at the moment for me with Spotify as a guy working with bands, I guess, is that, everything that happens on Spotify is still quite a walled garden. It's not very public. And those stats are available, and I can get those stats as regards plays. And I have to say, to their credit, the statistics and the info that you get from Spotify is fantastic, because... it's kind of all people listening to your release, which, you know, you can look at Facebook and that's all people that have liked your band. But a lot of people like bands just to say that they like them, and there's very strange things can go on there. Whereas Spotify is much more like the people listening. So the genuinely active kind of people enjoying your music. So in that respect, the stats you can get are fantastic. I've got the data, but I think my issue basically, which I was raising in the article, was that because play counts around all of their music isn't public and doesn't feed into services like Next Big Sound, which it's kind of an open secret that everyone knows that Radio 1 look at Next Big Sound and the public profiles there to gauge what's been going on with your artist. As I said in the article, it's quite simple. If you put a track on SoundCloud or you put your thing on YouTube or whatever, it counts on that graph that they look at. That then helps your case with radio for support. If you give it to Spotify, you've got no real way of demonstrating how much reception that's had. And as a consequence, you can run an outside risk of, Radio 1 misunderstanding your campaign. Now, I have to say, I think the article was very much using Spotify and streaming services as the kind of focal point. I think in truth, the actual problem, as much as any, is simply that Radio 1 is quite myopic in the way that they look at statistics around an artist. And as a consequence of that, you can get these very awkward situations arising where feedback from Radio 1 may be that they're not seeing anything happening, when if they just tried a little harder to look around, they might see that in fact, a lot is happening, but they're just not seeing it on the Next Big Sound profile. So that was the kind of thrust of it. But I think it would be good, and I think there's probably other, benefits around that for Spotify as well, to demonstrate how well the service is going down and things like that. Of course, as I noted in the article, there's no question it would lead to a whole new round of grousing about who's getting paid what and stuff like that. People will use it as a stick to beat them with, but I still think it would be a good thing to have happening, and it would give a lot more weight to bands engaging with Spotify and using it more as part of their kind of, I guess, pre-album promotion, because that's really what you're talking about, you're talking about the first single where you're coming back. You need that impact at radio. And once you've demonstrated that impact and you get a good result with it, then Radio 1 will be more likely to support you around the second single and things anyway. But it's around that point that I think is quite critical, and that's where Spotify could help.
But I guess there's a final part of that. You can pull in as much data as you want. You can talk about Facebook likes and YouTube views, and even if you throw in Spotify plays. But the final question really you want to ask is how much marketing budget and advertising budget you're going to be throwing at the track as well. So it's still... That's a massive factor as well, where even with all these... layers of digital data, they'll still look at it in basic cash spend. How much money are you going to throw at this? So if you throw money at it, it'll be successful and we'll get in there early. So you've got to, but obviously having that Spotify play, it's just another thing to get you get your plugger hired at the playlist meeting and get your artist or your track in there. So it's because if that's where people are consuming music, then it has to be part of, it has to feed into the wider media ecosystem.
That's right. I mean, it was only as we saw with the streaming charts, they were absent very noticeably for a long time until it became such a glaring omission within the chart structure of there's a whole raft of whole tract of the music industry is now listening over here that's not even being, accounted for. And I think the same applies, as a sort of measuring the cultural impact, I guess, across services like that. To ignore it is to do so at your peril. But I don't know if it is, you know, it feels like it's more of perhaps a UK argument, because radio is obviously still more prevalent here. So I don't know, Elliot, in your case, it's radio is a different beast in the US, right? It's not such a game changer now.
It is. I mean, it's you know, people on the internet, which is people having conversations, tend to listen to music on the internet. I mean, radio is actually much larger than anyone would think it is. Mm-hmm. You know, the conventional wisdom is that it's over, but there are a ton of people listening out there all the time. I mean, I go on, I'm sort of a regular on the WNYC Soundcheck, which is an NPR radio show that's nationwide. And every time I'm on there, I get people from high school and college I haven't heard from in years, and they're not finding me on the internet, you know. I mean, that's just one version of this. And I know I, on road trips, I'll get bored of what I have on my phone, or I don't want to mess around with it, and I'll turn on FM radio in a car. We could be nearing the end of that. I think the car is kind of the last bastion of FM radio here. But I wanted to bring up another thing about it. It's interesting to think about, a couple of the topics together that we were just talking about, which is, you know, marketers trying to plug bands and spend some dollars to get some impact, and Spotify's sort of lack of transparency with play counts, because if Spotify wants to be a place where people plug music and pay to promote it in front of fans, which they do. I mean, they've got a massive ad inventory. They're throwing out ads. I don't know if you've listened to the free version lately. I do it from time to time, and there are a ton of ads for a ton of songs in there. And if you're a marketer, you want to see a measurable return on that. You know, you want to see some number take a wild leap forward for your dollars. And so maybe Spotify could attract more ad dollars if it did add that kind of transparency and play counts.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so I'll just do a quick segue into the only segment of the show for today, which is going to be Ashley's Corner. Ashley's going to talk about mobile music making apps on iPad, iPhones, and Android, and all that. And here goes.
Hi, my name's Ashley, and it's great to be here, part of Digital Music Trends. I write a blog all about mobile music making called Palm Sounds, and I'm going to tell you a little bit about the kinds of things we cover and what to expect from these short interludes in Digital Music Trends. When people talk to me about making music on mobile devices, they're usually a bit confused and they wonder what it is I'm actually talking about. That's not unusual. I try and explain it through a little bit of history, so here's a quick go at that. So let's start with early mobile music devices. Anyone remember the Casio Vieltone? Good fun. The trusty Game Boy. Great for making chip tunes. Lots of lovely beeps. The old style Palm OS device. Not such lovely beats. Windows Mobile? So now people are using iOS to make music, and in all kinds of different ways, and using all kinds of different applications. People are using iPads, people are using iPhones, people are using combinations. I've seen people performing with iPads. But what kind of tools are they using? Well, there are loads of great things out there. And over the next few weeks, we're going to be covering some of the most exciting apps for iOS and for Android, and lots of other interesting stuff too. So to give you a taste, let's look at what's really, really amazing in the iOS world right now. So, one of the most exciting developments in iOS this year has been the arrival of Aria, a 48-track digital audio workstation that runs on your iPad. Lots of people didn't believe it would arrive. Lots of people thought it was vaporware. In iOS terms, it is expensive at about £35, but in real terms, that's nothing. So, we'll be talking about Aria in a bit more in another show. And what else is interesting? Well, another very, very amazing application is Impactor. And this drum synth has only arrived in the last couple of days, and it is truly amazing. More about that in another show. But it isn't just iOS where there are really interesting and amazing things happening. Android has its day as well. And applications like Caustic 2 are really catching up with the iOS world. Now, Caustic has a drum machine, a series of synths, and it has a modular rack coming to it in the near future, we hope. So, just as exciting. So, over the next few weeks, we'll be talking about what are the most interesting things happening in mobile music creation in iOS, in Android, in any other operating systems that you can use to make mobile music, and also looking at hardware as well. So there's loads to talk about, and I hope to be able to bring you up to date with all the news starting as soon as possible. Thanks for listening.
All right. So I was thinking of wrapping up by talking about a couple of campaigns that have happened in the last week in terms of news. So the first one was Gaga announcing a massive focus on an app to accompany her in the next album release that's going to be probably in Q1 2013. So even to the point of encouraging her fans to buy iPads for Christmas to be able to enjoy the album in its full extent. So the argument is, what do you guys feel about apps accompanying an album? Is this something that is only for a very few select number of artists? Is this something that is going to be democratized eventually and will become something that more artists can do without actually losing a boatload of money out of it?
My particular take on it is this is going to be an incredible shakedown in the industry, and it's going to expose the kind of threadbare artists that think they're artists and think that they can work across multiple disciplines. And I think that's all for the good. I think somebody like Bjork was able to do it because, like, the Biophilia app was conceived right from the beginning like that. And I think Lady Gaga is one of the few mainstream acts that can actually get away with doing this, because so much of her music and her presentation, it's heavily visually bled. There's lots of, like, reference points to artists and video directors and things like that. So I think she can convincingly do that. And I think this will be the idea of the app album going into the mainstream, because she's arguably the biggest artist on the planet, and she can actually push that through. But what you'll see is loads of terrible, terrible artists who don't have the same kind of artistic vision being exposed very, very quickly by coming up with something really flimsy and really pathetic, yeah, and trying to do the same juice because Lady Gaga did it. And I think more than doing a terrible album, I think this will really expose the shortcomings of terrible artists and hopefully get rid of them. So I'm all for it. This is like in Taxi Driver, this is the great rain that's going to wash the terrible artists off. I'm happy to see Ronan Keaton or whoever is trying and do some kind of whizzy interactive app with no ideas as their tiny pea-sized brain ricochets around their hollow skull. I'm all for it.
Well, you know, I'm a huge believer in the idea that apps will successfully replace albums. I mean, digital music, basically, it was a delivery system, and not a lot changed in terms of the artistic possibilities. You know, you have ones and zeros on a CD, you have ones and zeros in an MP3, and it's coming out of speakers, and that's that. You know, I guess we lost the album cover and it was disaggregated into singles. But that, those were the only two artistic impacts of the first wave of digitization. And the second one, you know, the possibilities are wide open. Everything that we listen to now, everything that we used to listen with, has a screen. Most of these screens can be touched or pointed at in the case of tomorrow's televisions. And just the range of what's possible. The Bjork app was one, you know, we all talk about that. It looks like Gaga's doing her thing. You know, Bob Dylan did one where you have to stand exactly in a location to unlock pre-release tracks for his album that came out earlier this week. And I think that there are so many different ways to do it, and that's what's going to make it interesting. Right now, we're seeing a lot of cookie-cutter artist apps where it's like, here are my tour dates, here's my Twitter feed. But as they sort of figure out how to express their personality, it's going to get very interesting. And there's also the fact that these apps, even beyond just an album, you know, having an actual artist app where an artist can maintain the relationship with the fan. And if you really love an artist, you're going to keep checking in. If they can keep the new content coming, they can actually own your whole experience and not have to use an intermediator. And it's basically like you've basically tattooed that artist onto this thing that you look at all day long. So I think for sorry,
I was just going to say once you actually get a decent sized community, they carry that themselves. Because I was speaking to Michael Schneider at Mobile Roadie about this quite recently, and he said that you should have seen the traffic for the Adele app, even though obviously she wasn't doing much because she's pregnant and taking time out to kind of get ready to have a kid. Even so, the community was so active that the discussion board was still rolling because all the fans, there was a point where the fans were just running everything. So Adele didn't need to do anything. She didn't need to check in and do an update. She didn't need to release a single. She didn't need to appear on TV show to trigger this discussion. There's a certain point where the artist has such a volume of fans that they don't need to do anything. And somebody like Gaga's got that as well, where the fans are so rabid and so interested in everything that she does. And it kind of goes beyond what she's doing. It goes into this kind of mindset that all the fans buy into.
Yeah.
I mean, I think from my side of it, I like where these things are going, and I like that people are experimenting with it. Because I think, you know, you got like a high end element to this with someone like Gaga, where there's obviously a fairly limitless budget can be thrown at it and everything else. And I think that's great. And I totally agree with Eamon that you're going to see a lot of crap coming in its wake, just as you do with everything. You know, I mean, the artist app, as earlier pointed out, is, you know, just reached a point where, you know, certainly when, you know, working at PS, it's the number of times where there was like an assumption that we had to do an artist app, and people just forgot to ask the one simple question, why? You know, what are you trying to get out of it?
Like, ask yourself, please.
You know, I think there's sort of two sides to that in the sense that I worry that just as with things like D2C and things like that, there's a sort of an assumption that there's a unlimited amount of attention from fans to spread among this. And that's not really the case. You know, you're talking about a fairly hardcore few, I think, would buy into it. And I think, you know, notionally, as a grand total of Gaga's fan base and reach, the number of people you'll see using the app will actually be fairly small as a comparison. And I think part of this goes on to my second point, which is that generally, I think there's people just want the music. You know, the Gaga is a musical artist, and then she makes music. Music is something you can enjoy while you're driving and while you're commuting. And, you know, I was involved with the Radio Soul Wax app when I worked at PS, and it was a great app in that it was like 24 hours of video mixes and everything. But as you know, as much as I loved it as a concept, the plain fact of it was that every time I was playing it, it was kind of on my commute home. And I wasn't looking at it because I don't do it. You know, you're on stops on a train and all these things. You can't sit down. It's not like you're at home and you put it on the TV and you watch it. And even then, if you were watching it, it kind of didn't hold your attention quite enough to make you sit and engage with it in that way. So whilst I think these things have a screen and everything else, I think it's more the experiential part around it and the community that will start to gel these things together. And as Eamon pointed out with the Adele app, you know, it's kind of, I think if you get enough of any number of fans in one place, they become kind of self-standing. You know, you amass 100,000 users, then they're going to just start to generate their own stuff, and you can almost set back and just let them get on with it.
It just becomes like a discussion board, and sometimes they talk about the artist, but it's kind of people making friends online, so they're going to be talking about what they were doing that day or what's on TV that night. So the discussion sometimes will be about the artist, and a lot of times won't be, but the artist has facilitated that conversation just by finding these like-minded people and bringing them together.
That's exactly it. I mean, I think people, it's only for the hardcore fans of an artist, you know. I think most people are going to install between 1 and 5 artist apps. You know, you're not going to install that sixth one. It has to be the artists that really form the core of your identity. And, you know, for me, that band for years was The Fall. You know, although I'm American, I love The Fall. Like, I just can't get enough. And it was my first experience online, pretty much, that I loved was this group called Fallnet. And it was just an email thing, you know, very much like what's happening with the Adele app today. And the only reason I cared is because it was like my number one band. If it's my number six band, I'm not doing it. And it also, that's how you create that like-minded community. It has to be people who like, this is their thing. And that's why they're similar. And that's why the community works. But even with The Fall, I mean, I would pay for, just says something into his phone and we all get it. Like I'd pay $1 a month for that, you know, but it has to be that top band.
Yeah.
I have to say though, I mean, you know, there's a different angle to this, which was, I mean, I think you've seen, haven't you, Eamon, the Gwilym Gold app album.
Yeah.
And that's like a much... It's an interesting thing. It's an area that I've sort of discussed with a few other people. And, you know, there's a few companies exploring this area of creating, you know, a musical listening experience that isn't the same when, you know, you play it. Elements within it change each time you play it so that it becomes effectively relatively unique each time you hit play. And the Gwilym Gold album, that is an app for iPhone and iPad, kind of does that. And it doesn't actually do anything else. So there isn't really much to look at. And things like that. It's very much the emphasis is on the audio. But I think it's kind of an interesting point, because a lot of times, you know, you either get a very token experience with messing around with the audio, in which you become the DJ or the manipulator, if you like, or you just get a bunch of eye candy and stuff to poke and push around while the music plays. But the music is still the same. So I thought the Gwilym Gold thing is actually pretty interesting, because it's kind of low key. You know, this isn't a guy equipped the PR clout of Gaga, but it's an app I wish more people would pay attention to, purely because, having played around with it, I think it's the start of quite an interesting area, which is that, you know, you've got a pretty good album. I mean, obviously everyone's tastes vary and things, and it's a little bit left field, but mercifully it's not completely in the kind of Brian Eno realm of generative ambient stuff where you don't really care, that it's just ambient and you're not really following a melody, it's just there. It's not in that kind of category, and it's kind of interesting in that sense that you do put it on and walk away, or you'd put it on your iPhone and put it in your pocket, because it is a listening experience. But I certainly liked the idea, and you know, and I think it's quite brave on his part, really, to make something that just in each instance is you hear slightly different.
I'd spoken to him about this and kind of the people that were involved with it, and I said that this may be something that comes in on the next album of the next generation. I said you should have an option to kind of save favorites, because there is that whole thing about the album. Each track's going to have a different incarnation, and you might hear a terrible one, and then suddenly, from your perspective, here's the definitive version of track 7. And you want to be able to somehow bookmark that. And maybe they limit it. You can only have one definitive version of each track, and that's it. And then you have to choose to delete if you find a better one. But there should be some reward for the listener to sit through all these different incarnations.
I agree. And I think there's a degree of... you know, I mean, I was feeding back to the guys that made it, and I was kind of saying then the problem is that I've not heard the definitive version. So it takes about 5 plays to understand what's changing, because obviously on the first play, you have no idea what's there and what's going to not be there in the future, because obviously the vocal line is pretty much consistent throughout. And, you know, so it takes a little while. And I think that's perhaps its weakness, is that, again, I think for the most part, people are actually a bit lazier than we realize, and they just kind of want to hear it. But I thought it was just a very interesting area, because, you know, you've seen people like Eno and do all this kind of generative ambient thing, and that's a little bit more boring in most senses. But I think the Gwilym Gold thing was actually very interesting, and I think if you applied it to even broader artists, you know, if I don't know, Radiohead or someone were to try and do the same thing, I'm pretty certain everyone would be hailing them as some next level genius.
Yeah,
don't bands during their future, but
don't really,
it's a lesser known guy, maybe not.
Don't really have that do that anyway, by just playing a Warp Record sampler in different order and wheeling over the top and calling it their new album.
Yeah, potentially so. Right. But yeah, well, you know what I mean. You know.
Yeah, I haven't heard that Gwilym Gold album app, but I'm going to check it out. I think Eamon's idea of bookmarking the best version is fantastic. And of course, then you'd want to share it with the community. And then of course, everybody would vote on, well, which is the best definitive version. And then of course, there's a re-release of, here's the static version of the album with, you know, crowdsourced production, essentially. I think that's a fantastic idea. And you'd get, certainly I would write about it when that re-release came out. You'd get a whole nother publicity bump, you know.
Yeah,
there was actually another company, but sorry, Eamon. There's another company that I've been talking to who they're actually looking for artists to work with at the moment, for reasons that will become clear in a second. But their idea was actually an extension to this, which was that you would land on a website or a mobile app or a mobile page, and you're given a song, and the song has a huge number of variables. So you're effectively looking at a sequencer, and you can say, I want this bass line or that thing. But you know, different, but not sufficiently so, so that you're still building the song, but it might have like two kicks on the third bar or three or one or whatever. So you can do all this, and then you could purchase your unique version and you could share it to stream only to social media. But the thing I liked about it, as a sort of twist on it, was that there were only so many variables, and it's up to the artist to set the variables. So it could be, you know, there's three bass lines, and therefore there's four versions of the song or whatever, because you've got the original version and then the three other bass lines. And so that's four versions. And then those four versions are made available, you know, and each person can only hold one of them. So only four copies could be sold. And so when you branch this out and you have innumerable variations, you could sell thousands of versions of the song, but none of the versions are the same because nice. They're all different takes on it.
This is basically Cabbage Patch Kids for music band.
Yeah, to an extent. But yeah. I think it's a really interesting idea because it would allow people to, you know, create versions that they like most. They can share them socially as their favorite, as you sort of say, you know, Elliot, and hold this stuff up. And I think in terms of marketing the release by way of virally sharing it, I thought it was pretty interesting. And I like the way that you can constrain the variables so that people can change it, but can't change it beyond all recognition. And
it's a bit like the MXPFour thing then as well. It's like a grander version of that.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it's just like a fully kind of built out version, taking it to the logical conclusion. But again, you know, much as with the Gwilym Gold album, I just quite like the idea that you're getting in at an earlier point to try and create things. Now, the reason that company struggled to connect with artists so far is because obviously it needs the artist to be bought in right from the point at which they're composing the music, because they need to create three or four different bass lines and variants on the bass line. And of course, if you're talking to labels, which is what they started doing originally, you know, the downfall was that a label doesn't care about that because they've already got the album as a finished product and they just want to put it out and get it sold. You know, I think it'd be interesting.
It kind of works more immediately with artists operating in certain genres. So kind of any kind of electronic artist, they can do that a lot easier. But if you're going to take a pop artist or a rock band, it's going to be a lot harder to do that.
Mm. Yeah, and to convince them that that's something that they want to do as well. You have to get the artists excited about it.
At the moment, I've been chatting with them, and there is somebody I was talking to that could potentially be interested, which is a not inconsiderable production house in the UK for pop stuff. So, it could potentially be interesting to see what would come of it. But I just think that whole area of kind of, you know, giving a different experience each time you play this music, and that could be really interesting. And it feels like one that's been slightly forgotten about by some people in favor of, you know, doing a Bjork to some extent and making a very kind of enriched environment. But maybe it doesn't need that, which is why I quite like the Gwilym Gold one in that respect of it. It's about the audio. Yes, it's an app. They recognize it's an app you listen to, not.
Well, they can, because it's called Bronze is the format that he's kind of built it on, and they're looking to license that out as well. He's obviously used it for, he did a single with it last year, I think, or an EP to kind of test the ground. And then he's just done the album, which I think has just come out. I got a test version of it about 6 weeks ago, 7 weeks ago. But they're looking to take that technology elsewhere. And they say potentially it's something that you could, the example they gave me was like, if you get all the stems for something like Pet Sounds and feed it through that, then you can kind of do your own remix of Pet Sounds, which could be really interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, I think it's kind of time to wrap because we've probably already run over quite a bit from the 40-minute target time. But it's been great. And I wanted to end by asking you if you have anything you want to plug in terms of like your websites or what you're working on. And also, I was thinking, since we've talked about music technology the whole episode, if you have any release or anything that you want to say, you know, this is great, it came out this week or last week and I'm listening to it all the time, then feel free.
Well, I always plug my brother's band, which is called Javelin. Right. When I'm not talking about The Fall, I'm talking about Javelin. And they're recording an album right now. I've heard some of the early tracks, and I don't think it comes out for a while, but it is legitimately going to be quite impressive. And I say that not just as the band's brother, but anyway, Javelin, check it out.
All right.
Damon?
I don't really have anything to plug. I'm quite kind of simple in that regard. I don't make anything. I just pump out words. I'm trying to think if there's anything remotely interesting coming up. No, I'm just punching out words for pennies, I think. Excellent. And that's it, really. So keep reading them.
Cool. Darren?
I suppose from my side, I'm working with Domino Records at the moment, and working on the Villagers campaign, and Villagers just put up the video for their new single called The Waves. Great. Which is insane. The video is just crazy. It's a bit like those strobing things that get you incredibly stoned without you realizing it. So I thoroughly recommend people go and watch the Villagers video for The Waves over on Vivo, because it's pretty awesome. And then beyond that, at the moment, my time's being largely swallowed by working with Alt-J, who are doing big things at the moment and have got their album coming out stateside on Canvasback, which is a subsidiary of Atlantic, I believe. But yeah, we're, you know, big things going on there, and seem to be favourites to win the Mercury Prize and things like that at the moment. So there's a lot going on there. Exciting. But they're a brilliant band. And I think in the UK, if you haven't heard of them, you've probably been under a rock. But in the US, certainly, they're still staking out their area. And if you can, check them out, because they're pretty special.
Talking of Domino, that's actually reminded me of the one thing I do want to plug. I have to go and grab a CD, because it's got the song title of the year on it. It's on the new Clinic album, which I have to go and read out. Hold on 1 second.
All right,
this we've got to see.
On my side, I think I just
I don't think the album's out until November, so I just got the promo.
Awesome.
So they used to have an incredible song title called IPC Sub Editors Are Dictating Our Youth. IPC was the publisher of the NME, which was an amazing, amazing song title. But they've topped it with track 3 on the new album. It's called Seamless Boogie Woogie, BBC Two, 10 PM, repeat.
Nice.
There you go.
That's the sort of thing you'd hear John Peel reading out.
Yeah. I don't know if you can read that, but that is the game has been raised. That is song title of the year.
Absolutely. I heartily
seconded. Thirded.
If you like Clinic, it's a great album, and I love Clinic. So that's my plug.
Awesome. And
on my side,
I think I would end by, since you mentioned John Peel, encouraging everybody to go and check out the John Peel recordings on SoundCloud. Now all the shows have been uploaded into a sort of SoundCloud set, so it's like over 300 shows, I think, which is incredible. It's an incredible archive of his output. So I really think if you're a radio fan and you know, a music fan, you should go and check those out.
What I think somebody needs to build a hack on top of Spotify that lets you play those radio broadcasts at the wrong speed as well.
That'd be good.
As a little tribute to John Peel. So you've got a 33 and a third or a 45 button, and you can choose
the full Peel experience.
The ultimate John Peel tribute.
That's a good idea. That's great. Well, thanks very much for joining me. It was a pleasure to have you, and taking the time to do it. And till next week, digitalmusictrends.com is a site, and you can follow me at digimusictrends. And I'm going to get your guys, your Twitter accounts on the end credits, so everybody can follow you.
Thank you.
Great. Thanks.
Thank you. Bye.
Good to talk to you guys.
Awesome.